Welcome to Yoga Life Lessons.
With myself, Debbie.
Me, Chris.
And also sometimes me, Lowell.
On this episode, we welcome Mark onto the podcast and delve into engaging with the unknown.
Wonderful. Well, welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. Our pleasure. We've been debating bringing guests on the podcast for a little while, and we finally found
one. Am I the first?
You're not the first, no, unfortunately. Esther has trumped you to that title.
Oh, that
but it's a me. High calibre of guest to follow, and so you should be proud
good
to
save,
succeed
save.
Her.
Yeah, absolutely.
How are you?
Do you want the honest answer, or how do you want the brevity, or like a real over sherry kind of?
I think that we want people to continue answer. Listening to the wisdom that will follow.
Yeah, so let's just
somewhere
wrap
in the
it
middle.
Up. Somewhere in the middle. I'm all right.
Good.
How are you?
Good. I'm very well, thank you.
Good. No, I'm all right, and I'm very happy to be here. It's always nice to be here anywhere, but I'm looking forward to
having a chat. Yeah. Because the starting point for this chat was you and I very briefly discussed the contents of your soon-to-be-available book.
Yep.
Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about that as a starting point, and then we'll pick it apart.
Sure. So I've written a book that should be published any time. It's quite vague at the minute, but hopefully the end of 2024. And it started off as like a lockdown project without any real intent there, deliberately I'm going to set out and do this during lockdown. I just did. And it was in the aftermath of, that swirl of things happening with the George Floyd's murder. Obviously, we're just finding out about what's going on with COVID in general. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot going on, wasn't there? There was a lot in the air. And I just...
Yes. Well, at that point, we weren't even sure if that's where it was. It was still on door handles.
Well, yeah.
But
yes. We didn't even know if it was airborne. And I was just noticing a lot of, mainly online, obviously, but I was still going to work and observing just some of the reactions to what was happening specifically with the restrictions, but also like the nascent BLM. Protests and so forth, and I was just I felt like I needed to put something down to make sense of it for me, and that suddenly became something like 20,000 words of exploring what all this meant, and it became a real almost flow state of just I'm sitting at the laptop, I'm down this warren now, this cranny, and it then just blossomed into like really considering collective trauma, really. So what was evidently going on in terms of the trauma of being locked down, people dying, the murder of George Floyd himself, that considering that as a collective trauma within a collective trauma. And then from there, it just kept sort of pooling outwards into using all of my training as a psychotherapist into like what is trauma? Why might people be reacting in the ways that I've noticed, which were largely quite there was a real like there was no empathy in what I was hearing. And it seemed to be very combative, and it was almost making an Olympic competition out of, well, who's got it worse? Whilst we've got this almost blanket thing that's affecting all of us, I thought, well, it's interesting that this seems to be the great leveler, yet there's still these hierarchies underneath that I was like, why? It baffled me personally why we couldn't just look upon, say, the murder of a man as a deeply traumatic experience and a really profoundly horrifying thing, rather than make it this sort of competition between... The book is called Victims, Aren't We All? So it explores victimhood as a sort of starting position and a position where it seems a lot of us want to be active in for, mm-hmm. for some reason.
As in, yeah. you think people want to be active within a victim complex?
Yeah, I don't know. So I'm thinking of Cartman's drama triangle when I say victimhood. So you've got on each point, victim, persecutor, rescuer.
Okay.
And this is part of my counselling training. It's something I've applied to my life where I think at any given moment I could be mm-hmm. sitting at one of those points. It might even happen in our transaction, so to speak, here.
You mean, currently persecuted?
I feel like you persecute me, Chris. Putting this microphone on my head.
But I think it's good actually to break that triangle down as something that has sort of microscopic and macroscopic applications.
Yeah.
And I think one thing that has come out of all this debate that really interests me is the sort of labelling of things as microaggressions and micro things, and there's this, like you say, there's this sort of hierarchy. But anyway, continue.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up micro and macro, because it's almost what I was doing, is taking these almost psychotherapeutic models mm-hmm. that are intended for, you know, like a microcosmic, it's an individual mm-hmm. model to use, but applying it to a broader social context, rightly or wrongly. I just, you know, there are some caveats there in that, well, no one model is going to capture everything, mm-hmm. especially when you're talking about humanity, you know, which is quite a broad scope. But I thought it would be interesting to look at it in that way. So the triangle, speaking personally, I would say I was very aware that I didn't want to be just projecting my personal experience onto this catch-all for the rest of the world. But it is true to say that I think I like to operate around victim, if I'm being very honest with myself.
When you say you like to operate, do you mean that's your sort of comfortable default in a situation or your preferred vantage point?
It's almost... Sometimes it's not within consciousness. It's what I go to. It's a byproduct of upbringing, experience so far. It's what I've interjected internally, psychically, that I've noticed through inspection of myself. And I think I've noticed anyway, when I think about how I relate to other people, mm-hmm. I'm often, there's some power in victimhood for me. And okay. I think it's a narrative thing as well. It's a story I've told myself mm-hmm. Since childhood. And in that way, that's what it's born of. But then suddenly I might go into, if I was to talk about, say, my romantic relationships, I've noticed that I would then shoot off into persecutor mode. So I'm sort of almost punishing in a... I'm holding up a partner to say, it's my mother, basically. Mm-hmm. And I'm finding fault to justify this victimhood, mm-hmm. but then I might move into rescuer when I might have the realization on some level that this is a bad thing to do, and then I might move into rescuer mode. So I'm trying to make amends or make this person. It might veer off into unwarranted pity or something, which isn't healthy as well. And then, you know, you just go around these different points. And it was thinking about that on a macrocosmic level of why I could see immediately mm-hmm. from the context of my lived experience, but also in what was happening culturally, mm-hmm. what we seem to be warring over is this, we're prizing this victim position mm-hmm. when we create these hierarchies.
Okay.
And that's what I'm exploring, I think, mm-hmm. across several tens of thousands of words. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's hard to think of a follow-up question. I think, my follow-up question is, so I suppose my comment as you were saying, or my thought at least as you were saying that, was along with that sort of favouring in some way of the person that... Yes, I think that the word victim is quite... loaded, it would on the surface appear to be quite a negative term.
Absolutely, yeah.
And maybe if we just switch that out for recipient, then it becomes immediately more tangible. And then alongside then the preference that they are in some way the recipient and victim, that there is then the rejection of the other roles inherent in that.
Yeah.
And certainly the labelling and the rejection of the persecutor role as this sort of, rather than a fluid reality in which, you know, we're all moving at different points. I wonder, does this have a model of a centre? Or is it a constant pivoting around?
I think in this particular model, it's just a pivot. And again, it's one model to look at how you... I'm trained in transactional analysis, which is basically... Yeah. It sounds more business-like, but the communication you have with another, what's going on in different ego states while you're doing that. So it's one model with which to work and just inspect what may or may not be happening when you are in relationship to the other. There is, I know, almost an inverse model, which I think is called something like the hero's triangle, something like, I can't be quoted on that. But there is, what you hit upon, I think, is the choice of language is always really important because there are connotations. Because victim is something I had to quickly address in the book, because obviously a lot of people don't even like to accept that word when they have clearly been the victim of some traumatic experience. There's a denouncement of that word for understandable reasons. I survived it. I'm no victim, etc. There's a negativity there. But that being said, I think there's also something about when we talk about victimhood, there's also one of the first words that came to my mind in the writing was privilege. That seemed to be the diametrically opposed word at that point in that context, because we're quick to denounce that word as well. And it's almost become a weaponized word on, if you want to talk about different sides, which I'm sure we'll get into. When no one wants to own that either, and I find that fascinating, in that things get really muddied because we're taking these words at a specific value. We're not seeing the fluidity of language or the many meanings within one set of letters. We're just going, no, I'm not that. So maybe particularly,
I could say that it's become a sort of static label rather than a signifier of a fluid process.
Yes, a signifier. Yeah, like I don't know. You could still be I felt like I was the victim of a crime last year. I had something stolen, but that didn't therefore mean all the other, you know, the weight and the baggage behind that word as well. I didn't feel like I was. I don't know. You might construe that as like, oh, I've been deeply. I mean, I was affected in ways that I didn't realize I would be, but. Yeah. It was. I could own that. I've been the victim of crime. I didn't have to. I didn't have to put up any defense to that. In much the same way, I don't feel like I have to put up a defense to all the privileges I do have. But I could see that the people who, largely white people, responding to the George Floyd murder, were coming from that angle of, we do not accept our privilege, which was interesting because I don't think anybody. Sometimes these things aren't actually said or thrown at people, but it's what they infer from the language. So when a lot of BLM members would say, well, you know, that what gets bandied about is white privilege, and then you've got a lot of white people saying, well, what privilege have I got?
Yes.
Yeah, well, you do.
A hierarchy of...
Yeah, it becomes a defence. We put our defences up, and then it becomes a competition. That's what I wanted to explore. How do we get to the point where we can reduce that? I think it was Emma Dabiri said that it's all being said, it's not useful to throw that back to white people. Or your how is that going to help anyone?
I agree. Don't worry, you guys can walk past.
Hi. Bye.
Bye. So, well, so it may be true. What value do you get out of, as say a black protester hurling like, well, you're a white privileged person.
That's why it's such a steady mic stand.
That's very, yeah, I get it now. Because whilst it may be true, how's that going to win over any white people to therefore collaborate and protest together? It just serves to divide. And it's a shame because it's all a matter of semantics. That's all it comes down to. And I found that really interesting. And where was I coming at it from? And how do I not come across, fall into the white savior trope? All these racial things coming up, and what right have I got? Warring with, well, actually, I'm allowed to have my opinion on it as much as anyone else. So it was quite tricky terrain to navigate, especially in a climate where you really have to be at the minute, don't you? Because because language is, it's almost like there's too much literal interpretation going on, little room for metaphor or nuance anymore.
Yeah, well, those labels have become like brandings again, haven't they? Which is a sort of ironic twist in the greater narrative of the Black Lives Movement. But I think you're right. I think it becomes very tricky because it was certainly something that we considered quite heavily at the time. And then you sort of get to that point where the labeling of privilege almost becomes an impasse, because there was a period of time where it literally meant unable to comment as a result of some prior affiliation with a sort of problematic development.
Right.
And so I think you're right, it's that question is, well, yes, you can throw the label back, but are you just giving a dead end in terms of almost like it's almost like a no win, no fee insurance thing? It's like, well, it's either this, we get this, or it's nothing, and it just
like a Trump card to call upon.
Yeah,
and it just negates any.
Yeah, it's like, it was your fault, you pay this, and then we'll all go away.
Yeah,
and that's the end of it. And it is in that middle ground of discussion that is possible. That middle ground of discussion will occur at first, I would say, internally anyway. And I think this is where you and I began our debate, because I shared something that I can't even remember what it was, but it was
to do with the business, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was fundamentally a statement that denounced the sort of insidious way in which capitalist agendas have snuck their way into socialist mouthpieces who unwittingly are simultaneously trumpeting the dissolution of something that they're cementing at the same time.
So they're co-opting the very thing that's trying to get out of the thing.
Or at least they've been so entirely subverted by that way of thinking that the statements that they're making, which have a semantic meaning, have no actual integrated truism for them. And so it's almost exactly the opposite of where your debate started, which is, well, these words have become too solid. And those words have actually become entirely devoid of any solidity whatsoever. And so it's interesting then, because throughout this whole period, and even more recently with everything that is going on in Palestine and the debate around basically who is and who isn't calling for a ceasefire publicly. And so many eminent spiritual leaders have been thrown very much under the bus as saying, well, you know, what good is what you're teaching if you're not standing up now and shouting this from the rooftops? To which some have responded well and some haven't responded well at all.
Right.
And it sort of loops back into this sort of fear of cancel culture and the right way to engage. And the whole thing, I think with, at some level at least, or at least for many people within it, a legitimate hope that there is a surfacing of things that need to be addressed, ends up in a situation where, rather than feeling free to respond legitimately, or even just feeling free to debate it, you know, feeling free to have a conversation, say something that is wrong, learn in the act of making that mistake and continue forwards, even that space to discuss something with the possibility of being wrong is sort of gone there. And so it feels like these discussions are simultaneously very necessary and almost at the same time entirely intractable. There doesn't seem to be a good way in. Says him, sat full well knowing that I'm you know, on paper, a white middle-class male.
And
that's constantly there in the background as well. It's like, okay, well, you know, I am in some small way a part of all of it. But to what level does that entitle me to comment? And how do I go about the process of being able to maybe not even comment, but contribute to a community more broadly that feels empowered to comment effectively in the varying scenarios where that becomes possible at all?
Yeah, there's something... I've got to be honest, like when we even just addressing this, there's a certain, like, something goes up for me. There's a cringe and an ick, because I do obviously err on the side of if we talked about a spectrum or a bifurcated culture, I'm certainly on the hard left a lot of the time. But that is almost always in conflict with, you know, where are we now, with anything spiritual, where there's a great deal of fluidity. In psychology, you know, I'm literally trained to consider things from every possible angle, on a good day, if I'm doing things right. And yet, here we are, like, because I still would say, when we talk about cancel culture, a lot of the time it doesn't even exist. You know, nobody's really being cancelled. Yeah, it's kind of just a
social media experience. But yeah. But then you say that, I listened to a what was it? It was a podcast. Mm-hmm. I want to say it was Sam Harris. And he was speaking to a documentary maker who made a documentary looking at terrorists in prison systems in, I don't remember the details, but she called the film Jihad Rehab.
Wow.
Which is a bold
start.
And I think the narrative was that they were it's now been renamed, and I can't remember what that is. I really should have
primed that. What could it be? If it's not Jihad Rehab, where'd you go from there?
I know, but basically what she was doing was she was following or at least listening to the life stories of individuals who'd been radicalized. And I don't know whether they'd ever got to the point of having done something as an act of terrorism, or whether they just were in a position where they were ready to do something, and she was basically exploring the traumas and the risks. And at one point she was talking about that there were some very complicated areas where it's almost even just the best, like, career option for some people. And so it was a super convoluted thing where basically her hope was to shine a human light into an entirely dehumanized topic.
And that's a word that kept coming up before, was dehumanized.
Yeah. Before it had ever even been watched, or, you know, no one had heard it. She was just aggressively and truly cancelled, trolled, you know, in a very real way, did lose everything.
Right.
So I don't know as many examples of that as that one. But
I think immediately it's somebody who I address in the book, actually, is Graham Linehan, who the writer of, you know, really successful co-writer. I always like to put that caveat. I don't want to give him all that credit. You know, Black Books, Father Ted, all these things.
Oh, yeah.
I spend like a good chapter on him, because I had an interaction with him one day. I decided, I don't know, it was a slow day. I must have been feeling too good about life, and I thought, I'm going to go on Twitter. And I'd been following him because I'd signed up in 2011. This was before he's fall from grace. I'm not trying to justify why I follow him, but... And he's just been on this crusade. He's really clearly willing to die on the hill for this, what is clearly transphobic rhetoric that he keeps posting. I don't think there's any two ways about what he posts. It's egregiously transphobic. But when you say, like, just cases of people losing everything, he's lost everything in a way. In terms of his wife left him, and I don't think he has access to his kids. Which as much as I think it's abhorrent what he's said and done, I empathise with that. That's horrible, because that's looking at him as a human being rather than a totem of bigotry or something, which is all we get reduced to in these interactions.
And presumably, in real terms, what he's actually just being crystallised into. If he is still prepared to to narrate that, not consider it, and every other aspect of his life has been removed from him. Presumably he is just further entrenching.
It's like he's triple, quadrupling down on that, but it's dressed up as this chivalric martyrdom thing, which is laughable. The thing is, when I considered him, because he is sort of an archetypical victim. He doesn't take any accountability for the fact that his actions were despicable, and still are, really. And he just blames it all on the ideologues of gender ideologues. They took my wife away. The reality is, he still gets gigs. He's had a best-selling book recently. So that puts lie to this cancel thing. And that's on the other side of the political spectrum. So I just thought he was a really good case study in a way. But now I worry that I've included it. I mean, I've got no delusions of like how widely read this book will be, but I do get worried that his little faction might come after us and try to cancel me. To be cancelled, you have to be switched on first or activated, don't you? So maybe I can't be cancelled. I guess
I would like to think that people who have intractable transphobic views aren't our primary listening demographic. So at least you can rest
maybe so
after the release. Yeah. But who knows?
But the problem, but that does speak to a part of the the objective of the book. Again, I didn't set out with this objective. It was an inductive process, whereby it's almost like I want to consider all this from what I'd like to think is a cool-headed, as cool-headed as can be, detached view, whereby people can almost unite over it. Maybe it's not uniting on holding hands and skipping down the street, but just we can meet.
Yes. Yeah.
Because that's how else do we do that? I don't know. Things like this, things like writing a book, how far they reach. Who knows, but it's doing something rather than privilege. They get
done.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know Noah Harari gets called out a lot in that sort of realm as well. But one thing he said that I found very interesting, again, I think in a podcast episode, he was talking about the writing process for human rights. And the notion that even though we can certainly agree that we all consider them valuable, they are still fundamentally separate from a law of nature. You know, they did not exist as a starting point.
Morals in general, yeah.
Co-created. And so the idea that there's not a fundamental truth to them, rather just a sort of shared, agreed one, becomes very interesting because... What you're starting to tap into is how collectively people agree that those rules can shift and exclude and include or preclude, and how do you engage with that process? And certainly from the broader sort of yoga literature, and certainly if we go down the more non-dual philosophies, which is where I would consider that I do go down, there is fundamentally this point that says, well, there is no ultimate right and or wrong in this. Either everyone's welcome or the system is incomplete in some way. There is a degree of ignorance there.
Yeah. And that to me really gets to the inherent contradiction of nature, of life, human life, if you think about like the social contract, Rousseau's social contract, for instance. Morals in general are a man devised, they're a construct, they're not implicit in nature, like you say. And it just made us think of you know, Americans with their constantly invoking the
Trump card.
Trump card. But also what am I thinking of? You know, when they're always bit like the Bill of Rights, Third Amendment, the time. You know, these intransigent, cannot be messed with, immutable laws of the world that we invented. We just created them out of thin air. And who made them? Who were those men really? And what relevance do they have today? mm-hmm. but people are willing to die on that hill. And I'm thinking of the word tradition, but then immediately I think of the tradition, the ancient tradition of yoga. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. These things are all existing in simultaneity in a way. It's like you're saying, it's almost a foible to invoke these traditions on mm-hmm. one hand, but then on the other, it's absolutely necessary in a different context, if that makes sense. You know, mm-hmm. as in the Vedic texts or whatever you want to bring up. Yeah. How do you? There's just so much contradiction in everything, and we can't mm-hmm. seem to. This is what I wrote about as well, like how we can't seem to find any. It's not even much less solace, but just like comfort. We're completely mm-hmm. can't deal with any contradiction. There needs to be a cut and dry, mm-hmm. black and white thought process to everything. Otherwise, I'm a mess.
Yeah, there's a fundamental right and or wrong mm-hmm. that we need to detail the terms and conditions of.
Yes. But underpinning everything I wrote is, you know, you brought up capitalism before, that is the common denominator, much like COVID was for a time. Mm-hmm. That was the unifying sky that we all lived underneath. Mm-hmm. I use a psychotherapeutic model or theory, attachment theory, mm-hmm. to consider capitalism as an attachment figure, mm-hmm. Like a parental figure, okay. which I got to organically, and I still am not sure if I've articulated it well in the writing, but I've just Graham Linehan'd it, and I've just doubled down. I'm willing to die on that hill. Because you can talk about the state mm-hmm. as the parental figure, but I really believe that the system itself is what is simultaneously providing for us and not... purposefully not providing for us is mm-hmm. I can't think of the word now, but you know, withholding, mm-hmm. And how that affects all of us, and again in a contradictory way, there is a hierarchy within that of who it affects more so than others. Mm-hmm. And my position in that, and just trying to be brave enough not to be too coy about the things we're talking about, like, oh, well, I mustn't say that. I don't think I say anything inflammatory by any means, but mm-hmm. I was constantly having to assess, like, is this mm-hmm. okay? Not necessarily for fear of any blowback or whatever, but just how do I feel within that? Am I okay to say that? I struggle with conviction in a general sense anyway, so it was quite the exercise to like really stake me flag and say, no, this is how I'm perceiving it right now. And I just think there's some sort of value in looking at it in those terms, in terms of how we relate to this system of being, the status quo, mm-hmm. and how it has ordered. Maybe it's from a structural or constructivist standpoint, like how life is lived, mm-hmm. And what we do about that. Because we are within that system now.
Yes.
So I even wrestled with, well, I'm writing a book that's going to be sold. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I am engaging in the system itself. Mm-hmm. But what else can you do? And that's not a cop out. That's just factual. Mm-hmm. There's so many of these, online guru types, like mm-hmm. Joe Rogan's probably the. The embodiment of that, or the, you know, he'd be on the crest, his big bald head. But hey, I've heard
not
him
just
say
a massive deltoid.
I've heard him say things like, it's this combative sense. So mm-hmm. I get it, and I'm gonna do this now. I'm a vegan, sorry, you know, and I'm talking about it. Sorry. But it's with a point in mind. Mm-hmm. So much of my life has been, since becoming a vegan, 10 years ago or whatever, mm-hmm. and this isn't, it's not a victim thing, I'll just be clear.
A vegan thing.
It's a vegan thing. Is people trying to...
That's not right. It's not a victim thing.
It's a vegan thing. It's people trying to trip me up on that decision. Mm-hmm. So rather than just being like, all right, okay. Yeah. It's, well, you've got a leather sofa.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's that kind of that's, I find that is the, where a lot of people are coming from politically and culturally is just, well, you can't, they're just trying to trip you up, and it's all like the.
Do you think they're trying to trip you up, or do you think they're just excusing themselves by?
There's an element of that. I've often thought, as conceited as it might sound, I've often thought, well, just because you can't do it, doesn't
and
preclude
don't,
me
don't want to.
Or don't want to doesn't mean that I shouldn't.
Yeah,
and I'm not on it. I'm not militant about it. I'll happily sit with you while you eat a cow pie. I don't know why I'd be out for dinner with Desperate Dan.
Well, to be fair, the other day, which makes me laugh, and people don't always help themselves, but someone was asking what options of milk we had. I can't remember the full thing, but they went, "You mean beef milk?" And I was like, "No, it's not beef milk.
Whoa.
We've not taken a steak and put it through a food processor. It's definitely just dairy. It is still cow's milk. It's not
and that
milk.
Goes back to the
I'm
power
not saying
of words,
that they're not related
it,
like... products, but it's not beef milk.
That's truly semantic,
know what
right there.
Beef
isn't
milk
it?
Would be like
beef milk.
But yeah, but anyway,
I feel a bit nauseous
thinking of
actually
beef
now.
Milk.
Beef thinking of beef milk.
Yeah,
maybe we'll have to bleep that out. It's a bit.
Oat milk's on the axe list at the moment, though, isn't it?
Well, what was I saying before beef milk?
You were saying about wanting to be tripped up and having a leather sofa.
So there's somebody there. That's in precise.
Uh-huh.
Someone going, you think you're a good vegan, but you're not actually calling it what it really is, mate.
Mm-hmm.
No, there's an element of that, but I think whoever said it, I wish I could attribute this to the right person, so I'm just going to claim it.
Mm-hmm.
People are just addicted to being right at the minute. That's all it is. It's this pissing contest. There's a lot of, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, it's grandiosity and whatever, all those words. Rather than just going, oh, okay, yeah, that man... To go back to George Floyd, that man was murdered in cold blood. It's disgusting. It then became this whataboutery of, well, he did present a false £20 note. I'm like, well, yeah, he definitely should have been choked out for that, shouldn't he?
He had
and
other
killed.
Things that weren't perfect about his life up to that point.
It becomes this tit for tat. I'm sorry, I'm
not
just
when
stuck
you're
on beef milk.
No,
not when
you're
making
beef for that. But
I've got the episode title anyway.
Yeah.
That's sort
beef
of
milk.
Beef milk.
Beef milk with Mark Hammond. It could be a podcast in itself.
We need to get that off the ground. Get that off the ground for sure.
Sponsorship. Who sponsors that?
Well, clearly Nestle. And who's the other one? Danone. Is that
Danone.
A thing?
I don't know.
Have I just made that up?
I can hear the sound.
What, the moon?
Danone. What's that?
What's who that? Else is...
No, that's just a cow noise. That's not an advert.
God, I just need a reset. What was I saying before all this?
I don't know, but
no, that trippy up thing, I think, is what I was saying. There's like this like piety about everyone. They can't seem to just accept the thing for what it is. It's all got to. It has to be personalised for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, when we went, there's a story I tell in the book about when we went to Bali, and somebody, I was chatting with somebody about like, oh, this generation. Really be struggling with house prices, and an older lady, boomer,
potentially, just
I
spent
don't know,
lots of time on the sunbeds,
interjected pretty rudely, really, when you think, and was just like, I'm not having it, I had to work hard. And the thing was, nobody ever said she, you didn't work hard for you, we were just speaking, something that's pretty. Obviously, there's no, like you say, there's no right or wrong, there's no, like, great truth, but it's pretty stark that house price, like, getting on the property ladder for this generation is way, way more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But she had to personalise it and take it in such a way that it was a slight against her work ethic or the struggle she's had in her life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where we're conflating a lot of things. And there's a big conflation.
Back into your victim statement.
It's not an
assessment of actually the experience of that person, but it's how does that person's experience that in no way was related to theirs.
To mine, how is it relative? How does it detract from my experience or say something about me? What is it saying about me?
Mm-hmm.
And why do we do that? And how do we get away from that?
Mm-hmm.
And I all I can come up with, and I'm not saying I'm not selling anything or any great answer or a workshop or a scheme to sign up to. If anything, I'm saying
just the Beef Milk podcast.
Just the Beef Milk. Soon. If you want to sign up to that and subscribe, yeah.
Subscribe
and like
the
that, hit the little bell
archives.
For notifications. And if you pay Patreon member, is that right?
Patreon, yeah, that's like a donation platform.
Yeah, if they want to do that, they can get access to additional. Yeah. I'll send out little sachets
they can see
of
the
Beef
landscape
Milk.
Landscape video as well as the portrait one.
Yeah, landscape and portrait video access, and I'll send a little melting cloth, so you can
make your own Beef Milk.
Make your own Beef Milk. Where
do you
was I?
If you've milked the steak, you can still eat the steak.
I should think so, because people don't even
just dry.
Some people. I mean, look at Desperate Dan. He had the horns in the pastry. So why not? Why even cook it? Some people don't even cook it. So milking it might actually generate some friction and some heat that might some way cook it. You can do that with certain things, can't you? I don't know. You can milk certain things.
Peas, nuts and potatoes.
Potato milk has been a revelation for
it's
me.
It's very good, isn't it?
It is, and I don't think you can really argue with the name of it, can you? That is, it is
it
what
does
it is.
What it says.
Ron
on the,
Seal,
yeah,
for sure. On the
carton.
No, the only thing I can come up with, the only thing I would sell, and I think this is maybe the whole, my whole philosophical outlook is, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I'm okay with that. I can sit with, maybe I'm fortunate, or maybe I've done enough work. I'm just okay with ambivalence or with ambiguity and not knowing. And I think that's somewhere we could all do with get.
Yeah.
And that, for me, would only come through the self-work and inspection. And I guess the book is dealing with the contradiction and how that is at odds and is in tension with an individuality with a small I versus individualism with a capital I. And how obviously individualism is a neoliberal precept that we are all encouraged to, you know, live under the tenets of you must be self-sufficient. You must be productive.
And it's your fault if you're not.
And it's your fault. It's got nothing to do with the environment. Ergo capitalism. It's got nothing to do with any social stratum. It is up to you. However, I do contend that the only way we can heal is by doing individual work on ourselves. So it's this tension between the two that I'm trying to reconcile across however many, I don't know how many pages.
20,000 words.
Well, 60,000 words it ended up being, because I got on my high horse.
So quite a few pages.
Quite a few pages, yeah.
I think that where you get to there is almost where spiritual traditions pick up. And I would certainly consider that as a teacher of yoga in some ways, that is what we're pointing people towards, you know. There are various methodologies and toolkits to do that, but fundamentally what we're hoping people will tap into is something that is true at a depth, at a depth that's shared and effective in that sharing, and it starts with that notion. Well, everything is transient, which maybe is not too different to saying you can't actually know what's coming next.
Yeah, and it's a very unsettling. We understand why it is horrific to really consider. Like, things come and go,
and that's our fundamental issue. And that begins with actually just our misidentification with ourselves as an individual, rather than necessarily an individuation of something. And I think then the question that I constantly ask myself as the person responsible for the trajectory of the business, if you like, or at least one of the people.
This business.
Yeah, I'm fully second in command, to be clear. Fully second in command. As the person that does the admin for this business. Are we so entrenched within the system by necessity that the capacity to fulfill that ultimate goal of saying, well, yes, this is the relative temporary reality that we live in, it isn't the answer to the problems that you're hoping that it is, but is our necessary engagement with that still taking people towards a place where they're prepared to consider, that actually the way to dissolve the challenges that they experience of being an individual is not necessarily to reify themselves as an individual so that they're more robust to those things, but is actually to dissolve that boundary where they consider themselves fundamentally and foremost a separate thing.
And if they were to do that, would that lessen? I think it would have to by default lessen this chronic personalization of everything.
I think that the first thing that it does is it decenters you in this triangle, mm-hmm. and says, well, they are a human and you are a human. I suppose the closest equivalent I can think of is it's a Tibetan teaching called the Six Realms.
Okay.
And it moves through various phases. So it has the realm of the hungry ghosts, which is perhaps the most well known, which is this sort of, it's characterized by this demon that basically has a really, really tiny throat and just this massive bloated belly.
Big shout out to one of my album covers has that image on it.
Does it? Yeah. Oh, I thought you were going to shout out to Gabba Mate and we just fanboy for it.
Oh, well, we can't. We can talk about Gabba Mate. Yeah. He's a melted delight, isn't he? I love him. He is melting right now as we speak.
But what was I saying? but the notion
something
of this
about
is
beef milk. No,
something about beef. Well, drinkable would get through.
Oh yes, chronic trying to satiate when you can't.
But what it says, which is different, is that actually you are kind of always floating in this matrix. And that you should never consider yourself as separate from it. Mm. But there is the possibility of harmonizing through awareness of where you are in that matrix. Mm-hmm. I don't know if this is from the original, but Christopher Wallace, who is the person primarily that I learned this from, mm-hmm. calls the center of that, he calls it real human presence, that the capacity to just be a human and interact with someone else who you fully qualify to exist on that level.
And that immediately makes me think of the polar opposite of that, which is, I mean, I mentioned Rogan before and I don't think I finished that thought, but just to say he typifies this kind of movement, if you want to call it that, at the minute, mm-hmm. of he was on his high horse as ever, saying like, well, these idiots who are anti-capitalist, what do you think you're doing on your phone? It's like, mate, the iPhone wasn't born of capitalism. It was commodified and sucked up by capitalism like everything else is. Yeah. It was created by a free-thinking tech geek in Silicon Valley who wanted to, whatever. That's an aside. But when
it gives a fundamental quality to.
But
the,
that's him picking
to the tool.
That's him trying to trip up the person who's trying to do something, which isn't helpful. We're trying to get away from this blanket misery we're all in, and you're just being the smart ass going, "Well, look at because you are personalizing." I can't allow Greta Thunberg to have an opinion because she's a little girl. And I'm a middle-aged man who's used to driving his big car or whatever. And it's so ego-centric and personified. But
he can't afford to cash in anyway for an electric version of the same car.
but I saw this short the other day and it was, you know, like one of these, is it David Goggins, that mad ex-Marine guy who's like, "Rah!" It was a kind of like a Wish version of him on YouTube. And he was going like, "I'm sick of people being rewarded just for existing. Like, what are you? You don't want to achieve anything." And this is what I'm like. A lot of the young boys and men I work with, they'll invoke people like that, or say Andrew Tate. That's their godhead at the minute. Whereas actually, my goal is, and has been in my personal therapy for a long time now, just to be comfortable in being rather than doing, and submitting to that. Just I am here, and I am. How do I find, how do I make myself okay with just being, rather than chronically and pathologically being like, I need to be doing something?
Yeah.
Which is a trauma response.
Yeah.
But then, it could be a trauma response to just not just capitalism, but I might not have had any great personal trauma in my life. But what my contention is that we're all traumatized by capitalism on some level because it is telling us chronic, like constantly, you are not enough and you need to do something about that. Where's the like what I think you're seeing is this through those texts, just be, which I would, is it the hungry ghost, Preto, whatever, imbibing to fill up, do, but it, you're a ghost and it's just
Not getting there.
Not getting there. But so, why are people like us often sort of laughed off as New Age or something, or I don't know. There's a certain impracticality.
Hang on, people laugh me off.
might just be me. No,
but it's true. And then it becomes, I think that the first thought that I have is that actually it is just very, very scary to engage that first stage, because like you say, that sort of propensity to, I can't remember who said it, but they just said, it's so much easier to break things than make things. Mm-hmm. And it's much more easier to halt the progress of the uncomfortable thing than it is to give it consideration. Mm-hmm. And you are very welcome to give it consideration and then decide against it. But
yeah.
But how often do people actually make that statement? And so, I mean, yoga has lots of wonderful answers. It's like, well, let's start to break down our assumptions, or at least it uses the word to sort of discolor, to make clear. And the idea is that if you walked into a room for the first time that was illuminated with a blue light bulb, say, you would be incapable of perceiving that room as different to how it reflects as a result of the blue light, which maybe is and maybe isn't how that room fundamentally is.
Yeah, we only have so much capacity anyway. Yeah. Yeah.
If you went in and it just had a white light bulb on, then you would see a different room that maybe mm-hmm. represented a truer version of the tones of the things in that room. Until you've seen those things without that colouring, you're incapable of perceiving what their colouring is separate to it. And so this is the idea. It's not that you then never plug the blue light bulb back in. It's just that you understand that that thing appears that way because it is what it is, and you have the blue covering on your, like
the tinted
bifocals. What do you call them? When they clip down.
Oh, the clippy ones, like Hunter S. Thompson.
Like sunglasses ones. Yeah. Like that. You can do as well. I'll lift it up. I'm capable of seeing through it. That doesn't negate its existence. Mm. And so one thing that will often sort of postulate on the mat is, well, are you getting closer to kind of knowing you? And for me, that becomes the first point, because the defensiveness comes from the identification with something that isn't you, yeah. but that you have labelled yourself with.
And this it's is a story essentially
the Yoga Sutra is just a manual that begins by saying, yoga is the state that arises under these conditions. Mm-hmm. You can do these practices X, Y, Z. However, if you don't do them, you'll stay attached to the fluctuations of your mind and emotions, consider yourself those things, and suffer constantly because it's based on a fundamental untruth. There will be no way ever to make that system work because it's built on a fundamental untruth. We saw, maybe Liz Truss's great contribution to the world was that she finally got rid of the notion that trickle-down economics has any validity at all. It's built on a fundamental mistruth.
Well, Liz has been rehabilitated by Holly Valance, I see.
Holly Valance, is that it?
She's a thing, yeah. She's still a thing, yeah.
Holly Valance.
Tonight you're going to get mad. She's a political commentator now, and that's a digression. She appeared at, I think it was at a conservative conference of some sort. Just saying Liz Truss is a great thinker.
Yeah. I mean, she had a great idea. Let's make.
She might well be.
Tax more poor people and stop taxing rich people, yeah. because then the rich people can give the poor people who need more work the jobs that they need to cover the shortfall.
And I cover that.
That's a massive, massive shortfall, and and I'm definitely not qualified to talk on that topic with any real gumption, but I'll give it a bash anyway.
And that's something else that the book winds itself into as well. And also, it might not be, I don't know if it's original or not, but I was hinting at it there with what I think is the infantilization of of spiritual practice or anything that's left-leaning. But it's because it's in contradiction to the practicalities of neoliberalism. So you can't, nothing has value unless it produces or...
I guess the problem is, and the reason that capitalism perhaps is so persistent, is that actually when it's working in your favour, It's so temporarily satisfying.
And who knows, like, you talk about power corrupts. Like, who knows if I was benighted with something now that I wouldn't go on a mad tirade and try to uphold the order. That's something that really you said in private conversation that really leapt out at me when I was like on me, like
in private conversation that shall remain private.
That shall remain private the right
thing
now.
Hang on. To be clear.
No, you were saying some awful things about some group. No.
That marginalised community.
Some minority group that you didn't support. No, you'd said I was on my high horse about capitalism, but then you said this really like stark thing, and I don't tend to get like blown away by other people because I like to think I'm the special wise one in the room. But no, you'd said like, well, is it necessarily capitalism's fault or that it's human nature, that we are so corrupted by it, that obviously the gains, they're ill-gotten and transient like everything else.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're paying a ridiculous amount for this burger that is that big, but you get it pretty quick.
Yeah.
That's where we put, we place all our stock in that. How did we get here?
Beef milk, that's how it, well, I think, I guess it's like on the topic of celebrities turned commentators on things. Jim Carrey is quoted as saying, "I wish everyone could become rich and famous so they realise that it's not the solution," which of course, unfortunately, is unlikely to happen.
Well, if we could just pilot that as an exercise, I'd be willing to, I'd volunteer for it.
Just rotate it through.
Yeah.
Hi, Jim. We've got you a sample.
I'll be your cohort. I've contacted Jim. I've directly tweeted Jim a lot over the years.
Just, and has he tweeted in return?
No, because he's part of the Illuminati.
Okay.
Because he's corrupted by fame. No, he's not. I love Jim Carrey. In many ways, I love that he... And again, he's somebody who... I know he's not everyone's taste, but he's like me dad. I grew up with Jim Carrey. I still love him to this day. I've invited my daughter to watch his films. And she loves them as well.
Triangle, where was your daughter in this interaction?
Definitely... what was the word, victim? She loves him. She does love him. But the fact that he shines a light on these things, and people do go, "What's happened to Jim Carrey? He's fallen. He's mad." And to me, he's like profoundly real all of a sudden.
Yeah.
He's saying these what seem like superficially mad things whilst making a face. That doesn't help. Don't get us wrong. In the credibility stakes. But when he's bringing up, say, the claustrum and things of this nature, and like the 33 vertebrae and how that relates to the Christ within and yada, 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 it's like, okay, cool. Yeah. I love you even more now. I liked you when you were,
The mask.
The mask, but now you're on this trip. Fantastic. But sadly, it's received with like, he's just he's mocked. Again, he's tripped up. He's bonkers. Look
so
at him.
He's just taken so many drugs that it's all gone awry.
Yeah. Look, we're going to listen to Ace Ventura.
His environment supports him to live in a falsehood.
Yeah.
Which is valid. Ironic because it's probably true on the flip side for so many other people.
Yes, it works both ways. Like, do you have to be in a... Is it a privileged position that I'm in to be able to even sit and consider these things?
Yeah.
Without being torn away by... Other things? Are we coming to a close?
I don't know. I think after I was like, guys, one more plug on the beef milk, and then
beef milk.
Well, I don't know. Now we need to come up with some sort of concluding comment because
we need an answer, Chris.
I think so. Within again, if we go into the sort of notions of the energy body, which are a great example because. People all think about the seven chakra system and then they think about a map of anatomy and they consider that it must reflect some sort of energetic reality. And when you go back a little bit further, and this is really before the seven chakra system really arose when sort of psychological discourses start to get involved and all sorts of bonkers people, and that's fun for another day.
Yeah, really.
But they're different unhinged. Systems, different practices, and the way that Harish describes it, which I really liked, is that they were always intended to be prescriptive, not descriptive.
Right.
insofar as like here is a tool that you can utilize until it's no longer useful. There's nothing fundamentally true about it.
So again, it's a literal interpretation.
It could be something that you can interact with in order to engender.
But it's been misconstrued sort of as much like the gospel of the word.
Yeah, and so maybe Jim Carrey is just an example that for whatever reason, at some point he's forgotten that the map was useful because of the route it took him on, not because the map was fundamentally, the map itself didn't do the work. You know, that the map was useful for him and maybe it won't be useful for other people. And then again we go back to veganism, because people get stuck, you know, they're like, well, I've had this chronic health problem for 10 years, I became a vegan and now it's resolved. And then on the other side of the discourse you have people who are like, well, I've had a chronic disease for this long, I turned paleo and it's resolved. You know, beef milk instead of that terrible oat milk stuff that's all over the Daily Mail or wherever it is.
Yeah.
But this conflation with, you know, terrain and maps and journeys and outcomes is in many ways what yoga talks about. And it gets very bumper stickery. It's the destination, the journey, and all these things. But where was I going with my profound points?
Well, it is the journey, Chris, and you're on it now.
It is the journey.
You might not arrive anywhere at this rate.
I was like, guys, I'm editing this. I've got to edit this. No. but it's the willingness to engage with that starting point. And so the map that I teach, it has these things that are called grantees, the psychic knots. And grantee just means literally a knot that's difficult to untie. And the first is called Brahma grantee. And it's tied by two things. It's tied by attachment and desire, wants and don't wants. And the basic moral of the story is that that's the first thing you've got to overcome. And you can overcome it by realizing that everything's so shit, there must be another path. Or everything's so great, and it's not worked, and there must be another path. But that's the first stage, is to say, well, I'm attached to this, I'm averse to that. Can I break that down and realize that that's a function of me thinking I'm something that I'm not, and enter into the uncomfortable territory that realizes crystallizing and pushing away those things isn't the solution. And like you say, start actual self-work, which begins as a deconstructive process, not as an accumulative process.
And I think that the first point of that is probably humility.
It's
probably the word I would think of, and sadly that's what's sort of
just decentralizing the individual.
Yeah.
And then this was the conversation I thought we were going to have, was, well, is modern yoga practice reifying the individual to their enduring suffering, or is it actually providing a platform that begins the necessary process of being able to dismantle that on a personal level, with the full knowledge then that actually the purpose is that prepares that entity, that energy, to interact more globally in a way that means that if we consider the individual the first building block of what is now the great behemoth of capitalism, where is it that you dismantle it?
Well, I would say that...
I think Afton just legitimately cleared his throat, but I'm not 100% sure. But maybe what we say is, let's have another chat.
Well, what I was going to say was,
go on then.
Why don't you come onto my show?
Beef milk with Mark Hammond.
Yeah, with Mark Hammond, you could be the first guest.
Wonderful. Do that. Let's do it, and then we'll pick up from there. And
that's not real, by the way. That's more likely that we'll just sit
fundamentally,
here.
No.
Nothing is real.
Temporarily.
Yeah, it's
it
transient.
Exists transiently, and we can draw
beef
nutrition
milk
from it.
Can milk it. Milk it for all it's worth.
There you go.
Yeah. Cool.
I did in a previous episode compare enlightenment to the hokey cokey. So I think as far as beef milk goes as an analogy, I think we're still striding forwards in terms of the coherency of this podcast.
There's definitely a bumper sticker in there somewhere, isn't there?
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Mark. I enjoyed that.
I very much enjoyed that.
I hope others do. I hope there is utility to be gleaned from that. And if not,
well,
at least we talked about stuff.
Well, this is it.
And maybe better people will do that. Exactly. Thank you. And apologies, maybe.